Our next guest, Jack Rivers, the University of Otago 2011 3-minute thesis champion, for his presentation yesterday afternoon, Cannabinoid Receptor 2 and its role in neuroinflammation. It's a pleasure to have Jack on the program. Kia ora, good morning.
Kia ora, how's it going?
Good, good. Third time a charm.
Yeah, it took me a wee while to figure out what exactly they want, but I think I nailed it there on their last one.
This is... So you've been a finalist in every year since its inception.
I didn't make the finals last year, and I made the finals in my first year.
And this is all basically repackaging the same research in a different 3 minutes.
Yes, a little bit, but also naturally I find things out in those 3 years, so hopefully... I found something more and to present, and it seemed to work on that last one.
This is, you must be coming towards the end of your research in that case?
Yes, hopefully.
Given a standard academic trajectory?
Yes, I'm somewhere near the university average, so I should be finishing soon, fingers crossed, knock on wood, but yeah, I don't know, it's tough to finish something in 3 years.
You're... dealing with cannabinoid receptors and its role in recovering stroke victims.
Yeah, yeah.
How, what got you interested, I guess, in the first place in medicinal marijuana as a field of research?
That's an interesting one. I grew up through the anatomy department and then I shifted to the botany department. I met some famous botany people that you may know. But I've never... really being a pro medicinal marijuana guy, but I was offered this research in the pharmacology department. It was really interesting, and I really wanted to treat disease. I mean, that was my goal when I was growing up, was, you know, cure a disease. That sounds awesome. So I went into this avenue. It looks like it's got some real research behind it, so that's really what attracted me towards it.
It must be something of a double-edged sword, I guess. The novelty value still of researching marijuana must get you a long way, but at the same time, I'm assuming in certain avenues of academia, there's still something of a stigma attached to it as a research interest?
Yeah, there is. It's there's some interesting types that turn up to cannabinoid conferences. So yeah, there is that stigma. Sometimes, one time I went on this radio station, they played all these marijuana-related songs before I came on. So it's that kind of stuff that kind of lingers around you, and you're trying to be a serious scientist sometimes, and then people just immediately dismiss your research because it involves cannabinoids. But you know, there's research that involves opium-like substances, and there's research that involves other recreational substances. So it doesn't mean you should stop looking at it for its medicinal purposes just because it's used recreationally, I guess.
Yeah, and it's interesting, in your presentation yesterday, you draw that comparison between the marijuana plant and the poppy. Mm. You know, almost as if to say, look, you know, no one's suggesting nowadays that that morphine is a bad thing, but opium and the poppy plant is something far more stigmatized socially than marijuana is.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, was your point that it could be, you know, better things have come out of worse vices, almost?
Exactly. Like, opium was used medicinally for 3,000 years and was made illegal, but we didn't give up on those good things that were in it, the pain relief and also the slowing down your intestinal function. So, like, you know, who knows, maybe in 50 years, it'll be commonplace to have substances that are similar to marijuana, which are taken, you know, orally or IV into your veins in the clinic. It could be a future of it. So we shouldn't just ignore this research just because, you know, Rastafarians and Bob Marley and other people like that, you know?
or embrace it blindly because of those same reasons.
Exactly. There seems to be this thing that marijuana can cure every disease, and some of them aren't linked at all. Like, smoking marijuana suppresses your immune system, and that's what I'm looking at. But then some people say, oh, marijuana treated cancer, but the immune system is an important thing in the relationship of cancer. So there is some evidence that, you know, cannabinoids may help cancer, maybe not. But it's really up in the air, so don't go administering drugs yourself. You wouldn't go down to the pharmacy and start scoffing pills behind the counter. So really, I'd advise going to a doctor and not going out and looking into treating yourself with illegal substances.
Yeah, we do have somewhat limited access in New Zealand to medicinal marijuana in the form of Sativex.
Yeah, that's only available if you have multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
MS. Because that's the only one that's had the clinical trials and really been shown to work, you know.
Is it hard, though, to get those clinical trials off the ground? It's one of those chicken and egg sort of situations, I guess.
Well, part of the big problem is that a pharmaceutical company can't copyright marijuana, so...
And other
big funders of the clinical research, so it's really hard to get that kind of stuff off the ground. But probably it will never be, let's go smoke a joint to treat a disease. They're going to take out the good extracts and they're going to modify them, make them better, and probably be administered orally or sprayed under the tongue, etc. They're never going to say, just go smoke a joint, because then you know you're inhaling smoke and all sorts of other things, so it's uncontrolled.
Because you're isolating... cannabinoid receptor 2.
Yeah, my particular receptor is not psychoactive. Basically, marijuana has many effects, and that's through many receptors. And I look at a particular receptor that suppresses your immune system. Although there has been a recent paper released in Nature, and it's an amazing paper, and it's top quality research that seems to show that the CB2 receptor helps these rats get off addiction to cocaine. So it seems like there might be some sort of addictive prevention. Which is interesting research.
Wow. The kind of the Ibogaine route, you know, like addiction interruption.
Yeah.
With CB2.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are far worse journals to get your research published in.
Oh, well, that's probably the best journal, isn't it? So it's obviously credible research. We emailed the guy and he said it took 7 years because they discovered it, but then they didn't want to just release it because they were nervous about it. It's obviously a big finding. So they took 7 years of research and they've finally been published in Nature with this research, which is fascinating stuff.
Yeah, why would you want to suppress your immune system? We're all taught growing up, Jack, that the immune system is an amazing thing and it helps us overcome all sorts of daily problems and viruses and things. Why would I want to suppress it?
Well, just like when you sprain your ankle, you put ice on it. And when you put ice on it, your goal is to prevent the inflammation. And inflammation really is your immune system overreacting. Your immune system is geared for survival and not protection of your own tissue. It's thinking that there might be a disease in there or anything. It's a bit like America and Iraq. The immune system is there for the terrorists, but it ends up blowing up the whole city. So what we try and do when it goes into the brain, we try and suppress the immune system's function just to peg it back a little bit. So it doesn't go around killing all the neurons and overreacting, really. So if we can hold that back, we can prevent the swelling, which is really bad in the skull because there's nowhere to go. If the brain swells, it starts to crush itself. So after the stroke, we're trying to suppress that immune system. And currently, one of the treatments for stroke is hypothermia. So that is that immune-suppressing idea. You constrict the blood vessels through hypothermia and you lower...
How do you induce hypothermia?
They put them in a bath of ice and they monitor their temperature.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. It's crazy stuff. That's one of the only things going on in the hospital. Yeah.
You're... I'm morbidly fascinated with how you do this, but you're conducting your research by inducing stroke... In rats. How exactly does one induce a stroke in a rat?
Well, I'm pretty sure. The funny thing was, is I remember when I started my PhD, I signed a contract that said I would not talk about my research on animals to the lay public because, you know, we might end up with protesters knocking down our door. And then I go to the 3-minute thesis.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. But we have had people knocking on doors saying, oi, what research are you doing in here? Somebody says, you know, I'm doing this to a rat, and it gets all... up in the air politically, but and then I go to the heats at the 3-minute thesis final and I do this very general thing where I don't talk about anything to do with rats. And the one criticism I got from the judges was that I needed to go in more detail. So now suddenly they're sending my talk to radio stations to play, and it talks about me giving stroke to rats. And I was like, this goes specifically against what I just signed, but it doesn't really matter. Basically, a stroke is a blockage in a blood vessel, so we just tie a blood vessel off. And it causes the same effects.
A huge percentage of postgraduate research, I mean, especially stuff that's experiment-based, so stuff in the science field, essentially leads nowhere.
Oh, yeah.
So the fact that you're getting somewhere with this makes you, I imagine, hot property, intellectually speaking?
That's an interesting question. Okay, so preclinical research, which involves cells and animals, comes up with these compounds that are seemingly a good idea, and then they get treated in the clinic. They get tested in the clinic to see if they're any good. Currently, there's 1,400 compounds out there that have shown to be good for stroke afterwards. And right now, in the clinic, one compound is being used and has found to be useful in clinical trials. And that one compound never went through preclinical studies, and that is really just a clot-busting compound, a compound that would loosen up that clot in your brain to release it and hopefully get blood back into your brain. So that's just a logical drug. And so there's this huge leap between animal and cellular research and research on humans. So it's actually not a big deal, seemingly enough, to discover that something may treat something in the animal, because the human condition seems so different. Probably a big thing is just the massive size of a human brain compared to a rat brain. And so you're talking about all these weird things with like a tiny blood vessel supplying a massive area of brain and the surface area to volume ratio, which is a...
So what do you have to prove then to get permission to make that leap?
What I could sort of say to myself and to other colleagues is that when you release a paper or when you discover something, you put a drop in a bucket. And a million other, well, maybe 10 other labs need to add more drops in that bucket, and then they need to repeat that and more drops in the bucket. Then maybe if you do it in a monkey trial, that's maybe like a quarter of a cup in that bucket. And then once that bucket gets full, a pharmaceutical company might pick it up and do this, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, that's what we're talking here, to do a clinical trial. Sometimes it involves 30,000 patients worldwide, so it costs hundreds of millions of dollars. So we need to really fill that bucket up, and what I've really done, my research, is one drop in that bucket. So
we're talking to Jack Rivers, the University of Otago's 2011 three-minute thesis competition winner. You have a gift, it would seem, Jack, for the analogy. We've gone into Iraq. We've got drops and quarter cups in the bucket. Yesterday, you spoke about, you illustrated your brain damage victims by showing a slide of a baseball player being hit in the face by a baseball. A knack for teaching. Are you interested in teaching? I mean, it seems, in my experience and a lot of people's experience at university, I don't know if you share this, you're fortunate enough to go through the botany department, which is fueled by fairly passionate people, but teaching seems to get in the way of what your teachers are there to do, which is their own research. Do you feel like you want to be lecturing, knowing that that will slow down perhaps what is already going to be a long road in your research work?
Well, when I was young, your mum would say, you got to go to university, otherwise you end up in a factory.
Here's another fantastic analogy.
Oh, this is a great story. This is a great story. And so you say, okay, you know, go to university so you don't end up in a factory. And you ask your mum, what's so bad about being in a factory? And they say, well, you do the same thing day in and day out, and you don't really talk to anyone. When you go to university and you end up doing a PhD, you end up in the lab, and you end up doing the same thing day in and day out, and you're sort of by yourself doing this research. And that can drive people crazy, and I have seen people go crazy from this thing. So research is really interesting, and I love the team concept of it, but I can't imagine myself being that slogger in a lab by yourself over and over, night in, night out. And some of these postdocs in Otago University work amazingly hard, and they do 70-hour weeks by themselves in this lab, and I'm too much of a people person to do that, so I could totally imagine going down the lecturing pathway and running a team of researchers, and that seems really appealing to me. So that's really where I want to head with that one.
Because you're also a residential assistant.
I am at Cumberland College. Represent.
Yeah. Great to see so many of the undergrads there last afternoon.
Yeah, they came to support me, which is really good of them. And it's a really good college. Represent.
Yeah. What appealed to you about living in a hall of residence? Plenty of people, especially when they get to a PhD level, can't get far enough away from the annual first year intake.
Well, they keep you young. If you surround yourself with 18-year-olds, they keep you young. I mean, just last weekend I got in trouble for chucking small stones at a dinghy. So they kind of keep you at that 18-year-old level sometimes, which, I don't know, it's a healthy thing sometimes.
Is it hard to condense 3 years of research into 3 minutes of presentation?
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest mistake of people that don't actually get into the finals is they try and cover all their research, but except for the tourism girl who seemed to finish after about a minute 30, because she didn't have much to talk about, I imagine.
Well, we could read into that.
She was a very good public speaker, but all I can say is I'm very jealous of her research because she just interviewed 15 people and then wrote a thesis on it.
How's that a sample size?
I don't know, but it's something I couldn't do. I couldn't turn that into 75,000 words. So I'm slaving away for data, and I was like, what? 15 people? You're going to be kidding me. I'd love to do some tourism PhD, actually. Maybe I should jump subject. Gender studies, tourism, one of those ones, sometimes became appealing.
You're heading to Perth.
Yep.
With your giant novelty check. Is that the first giant novelty check you've ever received?
Oh, I got a story about this one. I'm furious, all right? I go to take it home, and they say that they reuse it every year. So I wasn't allowed to take the novelty check home. That's something that needs to be sorted out up at the clock tower, I swear.
That's outrageous.
I know. I was blown away.
This is one of those moments, you know? You get your first giant novelty check.
A giant novelty check. That's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I was almost going to offer them $2,000 for the novelty-sized check. I'm thinking about going down to a Tiger printery and printing my own.
Is it, why do you enter this competition every year? What is the appeal in it for you, apart from, you know, an innate sense of competitiveness?
Yeah, the competitiveness is probably a big thing, but especially now, you start to realise that these things are really amazing for your CV. And the postdoctoral research positions are very rare in Australasia. Mm. You almost have to go to America, and there's stories about people getting vitamin D deficiency over there because they work so hard that they never see the sun. So I really wanted to work in Australasia, so it's about building up your CV, and you've got to win these awards. So if anyone out there has a postdoctoral position on offer, give me a text, okay? That'd be really good.
Jack Rivers, when is the trip to Perth? Have you been there before?
I've never been to that side of Australia.
Yeah.
Which is going to be cool. I'm eyeing up those whale sharks. Every time you see something about Perth, someone's swimming near a whale shark, so I really want to do that.
Whale sharks and mining. It's their two great strengths.
Yeah, that's their two great strengths. I'm ending up there at the end of the month. I can imagine town's pretty crazy. I imagine all the miners come in and fight or whatever, so I'm looking to go observe some of that.
And when do you expect to be examined on your PhD? How far down the track is that, do you think? Someone asks you this every day, don't they?
Yeah, it's an endless road, the PhD. You could actually just go forever because there's more and more to research. And at some point in time, you just had to say, I'm not researching anymore. So my plan is to do that by the end of this month, although Perth may be interrupting that. So I'm looking to end my lab work somewhere in October and then finish writing and hopefully submit just before Christmas, fingers crossed. But then it's roughly, in terms of amendments and marking and amendments.
Well, at least 6 months after that.
Yeah, it's about 8 months. Mm. It's the university average, 4 months for marking, 4 months for amendments. Yeah, so 8 months. I could have a baby in that time.
All the best. For all of those pursuits over the next while Jack Rivers, University of Otago 2011 3-minute thesis competition winner, cannabinoid receptor 2 and its role in neuroinflammation. I did find it interesting that you didn't go for the classic academic route of catchy title for the presentation, although catchy title generally means, in my experience, terrible lecture.
Yeah.
So you went for the prosaic title.
Mm. Well, I thought if I had a serious title, but then a completely comical presentation, is some sort of balance would be maintained there, you know?
A winning dynamic. And great to get a chance to present yourself and impress the new Vice-Chancellor.
Oh, yeah. No, that was really cool meeting her.